Good.
Stephen Barbie is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Barbie to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will air live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state that carries out a third of U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Pat McCann, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Linda Snyder, and special guest, former death row convict Clinton Young, and his attorney, Merrill Pontier. The execution watch for Stephen Barbie begins.
Hello and welcome to our listeners around the world on this Wednesday, November the 16th edition of Execution Watch, held whenever the state of Texas executes a prisoner. I'm Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for What's Your Story with Hank Rubicek on 90.1 FM HD1, Hank and the gang will be back next week. Tonight we bring you live news coverage as the state of Texas plans to execute 55-year-old Stephen Dale Barbie, condemned in the 2005 murders of his pregnant girlfriend Lisa Underwood and her 7-year-old son Jaden. This is the fifth execution carried out by the state of Texas this year. Carl Wayne Bunton, Casol Achantekamain, John Ramirez, and Tracy Beatty have all been executed by lethal injection. We're going to go to our reporter outside of the death house in a few minutes, but right now, joining us to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Chief Legal Analyst Larry B. Douglas, and our special guest, Criminal Defense Attorney Patrick McCann. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Larry, lead us off. Tell us what happened in this case.
Okay, Marlo, again, this is a death penalty case, as we know, which means there was a murder and there were special circumstances. The special circumstance here is that there was multiple deceased. A woman and her son, 7-year-old son, were both killed. Stephen Dale Barbie led a fairly normal life, and where he grew up in Fort Worth, Tarrant County, Texas. He was the third of three children. His two older siblings, an older sister, died in her early 20s when he was a small boy. And then his brother, she died of a medical situation. His older brother died in an automobile accident. So that set him sort of in the wrong direction, but his parents, both loving parents, both gainfully employed, were working on him. He didn't finish high school, but he did get a GED. And while he was in high school, he actually started a lawn service and started to make decent money as a lawn care provider. Actually started an additional business trimming trees, and he had a contract with the state of Texas to trim trees along the highway. And he saw himself as something of a ladies' man, too. So his situation was where he had a girlfriend named Lisa Underwood. His staff used to go by her. She had a bagel shop. Okay, he was part owner of a bagel shop. So his staff used to go by and pick up bagels at the bagel shop. He started hanging around. Then he and Lisa started dating. He was married. She was not. She had one child. Then they broke up, and she started dating somebody else, and then she started dating him again. In the meantime, he gets married, but he's still dating her. And she comes to him with the news that, you know, I'm dating somebody else. I'm dating you, too. I'm pregnant. And I think the child is yours. And that he wasn't having that. Now, as it turns out later, DNA testing shows that the child was not his. But he believed the child was his, and she told him the child was his, and she told a friend of hers that, you know, the child is his. And besides, I'd like for my child, the little girl, I'd like for my child to get health insurance. Okay, so she told him that the child was his, and they were planning a baby shower. The night before the baby shower, he and one of his employees, Barbie never had any kind of criminal record, but his employee, a guy named Ron Dodd, was on parole for family violence. Dodd comes by and picks him up. They go to Lisa's house. His whole idea was, I'm going to go in, I'm going to start an argument with her, and then I get into a fight with her, and maybe I can take her out at that point. So he goes and gets into an argument with her, and she just is not having any of it, so he leaves. He goes back again, and then this time he gets into a fight with her, and she's been a little bit ill. She has some respiratory problems, and so does her son. He got into a fight with her, and he punched her in the face. And then he throws her down, and he's pressing her face against the floor, apparently broke her arm. And the complication of the baby inside her stomach and her respiratory issues ended up in her just not being able to breathe anymore, and she dies. While in the process of doing that, her son, Lisa's son, Jaden, 7-year-old, he comes in, and he's having a total fit. And he ends up grabbing the little boy to shut him up, and he closes his airways off too, and he dies. Then he cleans up the mess. That's according to what the facts of the case show. Tries to clean up everything, and he puts her in her own SUV to go and dispose of the bodies. So he's there in Fort Worth. He goes up north to Denton County because he and his buddy figured out the best way to dump a body, the best place is in the rural area. So he goes up there and he has the bodies are found and her vehicle is found at that point, but nobody was found later. But she hadn't been shown to be missing yet. An officer actually happens by to see him walking on the road because his friend had left him. So he's out trying to find his friend, trying to find Ron Dodd. And Sheriff Deputy David Brawner sees him walking around. He tries to investigate why somebody out here in this rural area by himself. It's wet, it's cold, and he's wet. And he's covered with mud. And he asked him what his name is. He gave the name David Weekly. Officer thought, well, now that's a builder in the company and in this neighborhood. So are you sure that's your name? Give me name and date of birth. So he gives him that name and date of birth. He's checking it just to verify it while he's trying to verify it. And he stopped his patrol vehicle, and the patrol vehicle's headlights are right on them, and the dash cam is right on them. And when when the officer is checking to verify the identity, Barbie takes off, and they don't catch him. Okay, they don't catch him right away. So he goes home, takes a bath. Goes back to Ron's house. Ron Dodd picks him up, goes back to Ron Dodd's, and goes home like nothing ever happened. Then Lisa doesn't show up for the baby shower the next day. She said she's going to be there. People were wondering what happened to Lisa. Her mother goes to the house, sees something looks kind of strange. They call the police. They go in there and find that, you know, there's some pink stuff on the carpet. It's turned out it was her blood. He tried to clean it up. And they knew that something had happened to her when the police went by. As they're investigating this case, then the officer says, wait a minute, I saw a guy out there in the area earlier. They find the car. They don't find the bodies. The bodies in a shallow grave. And so the next few days, Barbie's crew has a job to do in Tyler, like 300, but two, couple hundred miles, couple hours away from Fort Worth, going to East Texas. But by the time they put everything together, they went to Tyler already with an arrest warrant for him. They call him, ask him to come by and talk to them. He goes by to talk to them. They meet in the Walmart parking lot.
How did they figure out it was him?
They had a fairly good video on him. When she came up missing, the girlfriends just named him right away. It must have been him. So they thought they had him, and they told him that they had him, but somehow they were able to get an arrest warrant. They had enough to get an arrest warrant. But they go up, and they're talking to him in the Walmart parking lot, and then they said, well, let's just go to the sheriff's office in Tyler. And they take him and his coworker and his wife, who had actually gone with him, so they could spend some time in Tyler because if he had any downtime. And they take him to the Tyler police station inside an investigation room. He says, I have no idea anything about her at all. I mean, I knew her, but I haven't seen her in months. They said, well, you know, we've got a little information. We saw you out there on the road. Okay, I was there, but I had nothing to do with anything. So then they come back. They said, well, you know, your friend Ron, he's about to turn over on you for everything. He's still holding on, and then finally he says, look, I got to go to the bathroom. So everything is on video, except he goes to the bathroom. And the officer, this is Michael Carroll, goes to the bathroom with him. They're in the bathroom talking for about 45 minutes. Okay, now none of this is on video. They're in the bathroom talking for about 45 minutes, and they come back and they get him to sign a full confession on video after he'd been warned already. What happened in the bathroom, I don't know, but after the bathroom, he signs a total and full confession as to the details of the incident. And so then there's a trial, and he's found guilty. He didn't have any real serious criminal history, but the details of the underlying offense are sufficient. You've got to have the two things for capital death is future danger, and future danger can be shown from the incident itself, and then refuting mitigation, and there was enough mitigation to save his life, so he was given the death penalty in this case.
What happened to Ron Dowd?
You know, I looked around. And wasn't able to find that out. I wasn't able to find that out at all. But he was a co-defendant. But when I looked that up, I didn't wrap up that.
Well, this is Stephen's third date with death in 4 years. Can you tell us anything about his past days and appeals?
There is a most recent attempt at a stay was a variation on Mr. Ramirez's complaint, which is that he wasn't able to have a spiritual advisor pray with him or pray over him in the execution chamber. Judge in Houston had issued a stay, but the TDCJ officials apparently accommodated the designer, and so the execution should go forward, barring something else happening. But
I don't understand. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court was considering Barbie's request. We got that on a forced stay based on unresolved claims of interference by Texas prison officials with his right to freedom of religion. But we know that spiritual advisors have been allowed into the death chamber. We know that the Rev was there with John Ramirez. Why is the state of Texas refusing to make a policy ruling?
The traditions in TDCJ are that the warden decides what is policy. It's the same sort of devolved authority that they've always had. Each warden runs his own prison or her prison the way they wish. And TDCJ is probably reluctant to create a policy that they feel will simply be attacked. I'm not defending it.
No, you're explaining it.
but I believe that they simply didn't want to create a policy which they thought would then somehow become a problem itself. They did try and accommodate him at the last minute, and that appears to have removed the religious objection.
You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, Houston Media Source, for the video. It's 6:15. We have spoken with our correspondent who is in Huntsville outside of the death house, and she said that the witnesses have crossed the road at 6:07, which is our indication that the execution has begun. We will be checking in, if possible, with a couple of our people, including Linda Snyder from outside of the death house, a little bit later on. We know it's cold. We know that it's a terrible place to be inside or outside of the death house. And we hope to get our technology working so that we can speak with them. A little bit more, if you can, about this case. So if we're concerned about the freedom of religion, we're concerned that his spiritual advisor may not be allowed in, but that wasn't his only problem, was it?
Well, on this last gasp attempt, it appeared to be the only issue that went up for cert.
And for people like me with no legal background?
Certiorari is a review by the Supreme Court of a lower federal or state decision. And they have supervisory powers over all 50 states and all the circuits. This request for stay went up on religious basis and was well argued. It was within the Ramirez decision guidelines. It's simply that it appears that the response is that the TDCJ officials were going to allow his spiritual advisor, and I'm not sure what denomination it is, to be inside and to pray with him and over him. So if that accommodation is made, then there is no more First Amendment objection. The difficulty here is, Larry pointed out in his summation of the facts, is that there's not a great deal of mystery as to what happened here. There was an eyewitness, there was forensic evidence, there was a confession. The issues are going to be typically involving effective assistance of counsel, other constitutional issues that resolve around a fair trial and a fair review process. He has, at this point, I think, simply run out of options. And the other part of this is, and this is one of the odd challenges, Larry brought it up well, is that you have a shocking crime to the average juror, and you also have a lack of explanation as to why this happened other than selfishness, because there is no, for instance, brutal childhood that might have explained the impulse to do violence. There is no history of mental illness, at least that was discovered, or mental disability. So the truth of this is that it is often times when a person has not got a long violent history or a tragic upbringing, it's difficult for a jury, I think, to wrap their head around the fact that this could happen without something underlyingly wrong with the person. And I think that's where they wound up with this fellow.
And then clearly, to try to show future danger for someone who has is apparently not that great a future danger, was they did introduce at trial some relationship issues that he had. There were some claims that he and an ex-wife had gotten into a big argument. She called the police. The police came out. Could not even determine, who might have been at fault. They introduced evidence in terms of she either passed out or he knocked her out or something, and she complained that when she came to, that he wouldn't even drive her to the hospital, so she drove herself, and that was considered to be, and he just said, you know, we got into an argument, but the police didn't arrest anybody, didn't charge anybody with anything. And there was one other young lady that I think he was trying to talk to. Well, he saw himself as something of a ladies' man anyway. The other young lady he was trying to talk to, a former co-worker of his at UPS, he, you know, was suggesting to her, he was trying to get together with her. He mentioned to her that he had a tree service company. She said, would you give me a bid on trimming some trees at my house? He never gave her a bid, but he goes to her house and trims the trees. And after he trimmed the trees, she called him and said, you know, I never gave you authorization to trim the tree. I just wanted to get a bid. He goes off on her, and according to them, but in terms of him ever having done anything to anybody, no, nothing criminal, no criminal record whatsoever in his case. There were some juvenile things that I think that his parents took care of. He got in trouble in school, and they sent him to a religious school. And some of the people from the religious school even came out and testified for him at punishment. The issue was raised in terms of his concerns about his lawyer after he pleads not guilty. He says his lawyer, in essence, admitted his guilt to the jury. Apparently, the attitude of the lawyers that if we admit the guilt, then they'll be less likely to give him the death penalty. It appears that there was no suggestion that he was opposed to that position of admitting guilt. But he says, I never got to oppose it because I didn't know the guy was going to do it. Okay. So, but if Clint, Pat, you were mentioning that it appears that Texas is going to grant him the accommodations in terms of his religious leader being right there and touching him and so forth. Although it's not a policy, it appears that they're going to do it. We don't know what's going to. They probably will, but we really don't know at this point since it's not a policy.
And the lack of policy may be again because there are many faiths that people come to on the row and come with to the row, and if they have an unusual demand, then perhaps they're trying to deal with this on a case-by-case basis, as I think as far as most of us are concerned, in a person's last moments, they can have somebody do whatever they want to, as long as there's not a security issue, and there never has been.
So this sounds like a dog whistle saying that there are only certain types of religion that the state of Texas wants to actually admit to or to acknowledge?
Defending it, but I would not put it that way. I'm simply saying that if, for instance, if someone wanted practice Santeria and wanted to have a ritual sacrifice performed in the death chamber, that might cause some concerns. If someone had an unusual faith that, you know, for instance, required some drug or some incense burning. I don't think that would probably be permitted, but I don't know what the thought process was. It certainly seems reasonable to ask any person to have somebody say a prayer over them before they're to be executed. But again, having stated the principle that the religious beliefs of the person to be executed should be reasonably accommodated, probably the Supreme Court is going to let states try and figure that out as they go. It is been raised by Mr. Ramirez. It's now the law. And there have been two executions. This is the one that has raised that issue.
Well, since it has been raised, and why wouldn't SCOTUS come down on something like this? They seem to have been leaning towards things that defend religion. They've already come up with something before that said, you have to do this, state of Texas. Why would they not interfere in something like this? Doesn't that, well, not respect their authority?
But based on what Pat is saying, though, the impression I get is that rather than developing a policy, because the policy, once you announce the policy, it would be subject to challenge. The state seems to take the position, well, tell me what it is you want, and then we can decide whether we're going to grant it to you. In this case, we can make the accommodation. So if the accommodation is made, then you have no cause to complain. And the concern from the state's point seems to be that, you know, once we announce a policy, then that just gives the opportunity to come forward and complain about the policy rather than trying to address what the request actually is. That appears to be the position they're taking.
Shouldn't the state of Texas be paying attention to any possible objection? I mean, this is a man's life.
I don't think they're trying to ignore it. I think, as Larry said, they're simply trying to, well, okay, what do you want?
Yeah.
And if it's reasonable, we'll do it. If it's not, then we'll say no, and you tell a judge to tell us that we have to. And again, not trying to defend them, I'm just saying that given the variety of faiths that we all have and we all believe in deeply, I'm not sure it's irrational for them to try and wait and see what someone actually wishes at their deathbed.
And there are all sorts of issues that arise after the fact, after the trial, after the appeals. Something that was not raised during the trial process. But these cases we discussed earlier, it's amazing how much notoriety they get. The Stephen Barbee's case is actually, there's been a book published on that incident, which brings to bear a lot more issues than we've discovered here in the recorded, in the record. But some of the issues that are now being raised is that particularly when you have the situation where his friend, Ron Dodd, Barbee has the business. Dodd worked for him, and they became employee. Then they became close friends, and they became then best friends. But Barbee's now making the claims to some, you know, that is, I'm talking about the extra outside the court, outside the record claims that this whole thing was not me. It was Ron Dodd. He's the convict. Okay. And the relationship is that Dodd at the time was dating Barbee's ex-wife. And the outside chatter is that the ex-wife might have had some sort of a vendetta or an insurance policy on him, and that Dodd was trying to kill him. There was some episode raised after the fact that there was an accident on a tree trimming incident that somehow maybe Dodd had tried that, and so what Barbee claimed later is that Dodd is the one who did all this. And Dodd is now turning on me, claiming that I'm the one who did it. I'm the one who killed my supposedly pregnant, my pregnant ex-girlfriend, and the baby's mine. He's saying that, well Dodd did it all, or whatever I did under Dodd's direction. But that argument hasn't gone anywhere.
Well, go ahead.
No, please.
I think the trial is a good example. The trial was done back in a time when it was a reasonable strategy to acknowledge guilt and hopefully have the individual express remorse. Now, under McCoy v. Louisiana, Justice Ginsburg wrote that the defendant, if they're competent, has the right to direct the purpose of their defense, which, if the defendant wishes to maintain his innocence, that is his right, and it is the lawyer's job to try and argue that somehow. despite whatever evidence may be there, or to withdraw. And that was not the law at the time, but it is the law now, and it is an interesting problem because you're faced with a client who may wish to maintain that they never did this, were never there, or whatever, and yet there's video, there's a confession, there's forensic evidence. So you're often in the position of arguing with one's own client about what the best strategy is. And that is not always clear, depending on where things go. And a lot of clients are not willing to acknowledge guilt and express remorse, which I think is what would be the goal of most juries, to discern whether or not someone has regretted this, could be someone who would not be a future danger.
It is 6:31. You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, Texas. Thank you for joining us. If you have tuned in for What's Your Story with Hank Rubicek, please check again next week, and Hank and the gang will be back. Right now, you are listening to Execution Watch, and we are here talking to our panel of Larry Douglas and Pat McCann. And this is not his only excuse or his only reason to have asked for a stay. There were other reasons before this, before the religious. Is that correct?
Larry, didn't his one of his earlier requests go about or challenge the lawyer's decision to acknowledge guilt?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
But I think there were even some. I believe I saw something about that. There were even some COVID issues that caused the delay. But these delays are not unusual. But since the delays have occurred, Barbie is now recanted all of the confessions that he made. And he's taking a totally different position than he did during the trial and even during the direct appeal process. He's saying that, none of those confessions were true. They were coerced. And that's the 45-minute bathroom trip, which really makes no sense to me, that they pretty much already had everything that they needed, a bit of overkill, if excuse the expression, to have him have an off the record discussion, especially of that length. Now, what do two guys talk about in the bathroom? That concerns me. When they went with seemingly overwhelming evidence. And they were questioning Barbie in one room and Dodd in the other room. And so it made it easier for them to say, but Dodd's in the other room over here, and this is what he's saying. And there were some distinguishing facts, I guess, because the bodies were buried, and Dodd and Barbie were doing things together, but Barbie was the most active player. Barbie is the one who had mud all over him, and when they went to find the graves, the shallow graves, Dodd can only provide so much information. Dodd provided them the information that got them into the area, which suggests that Dodd and Barbie did coordinate in the general area where it was going to be, but Barbie. They could not find the graves without Barbie's assistance. And when they went to, according to the record, to find the graves, Barbie says, "Oh, I can tell you where they are, but I don't want to see them myself. I don't want the news media to see me on any of this." And when they go to the sites, Barbie was directing them very specifically. "You're going too far. No, that's back over that way. Just a little bit more. Okay, a little bit more. It's under some brush. Those kinds of things that really, I think, pretty much sealed his fate in terms of where the bodies were located. His detailed confession suggests that Dodd says, "I'm not digging any holes. You're going to dig the holes yourself." And he was covered with mud, and he was very wet. Dodd drove off. He was looking for Dodd, and Dodd finally came back. Later, kept calling Dodd back, and so Dodd did come back, and they went to back to Dodd's house, where Barbie picks up his truck, and then Barbie goes home, and then goes back to business as usual. And I think those kinds of facts, the relative callousness on his part, and the going on about his life, and it was pretty clear that his overriding concern was the new wife. He was married just for a few months. She was already there, and they then let her go into the examining the exam room. Yes, they let her go into the room. And what the detectives do is he wanted to talk to her, and she wanted to talk to him, and she confronts him. And they yell back and forth at each other, and she's asking him all kinds of questions. They left the cameras running, which clearly they were going to do. But they left the cameras running and created the impression that they were, I don't know how you can create this impression, but maybe it worked, that they were having a private conversation. And he was complaining about, you know, that actually coming in. The lawyers tried to convince her to stay with him, at least through the trial. She stayed for a couple of months and says, "Nah, I got to get out of here." So she went ahead and divorced him. But he apparently was extremely concerned about preserving that relationship. He had gotten married to her. He knew her from years before. They reconnected. She had been married. She had two children. And he was close to him, close to the children, and close to her, and she was really trying her best. He was really trying his best to hold on to that, and that's really what he told Lisa, Lisa Underwood, you know, who named him, says, you know, "You are the father of my unborn child, my daughter. You are the father," and his concern from then on was like, you know, you're gonna ruin my marriage. You can't do this to me. And that was his clear motivation, based on what he was saying.
It looks like we're being joined in just a few moments by Meryl Pontier, who we will be talking to. She is the attorney for Clinton Young.
There she is.
In fact, when Elizabeth Stein and Ray Hill began broadcasting Execution Watch in the summer of 2008, it was the beginning of our use of community media for nearly 15 years to shine a light on the disproportionate use of the death penalty here in Texas. Even nationally, the Lone Star State remains an outlier. Few other states still use the death penalty, and two new surveys show that support for capital punishment by Americans remains at nearly half-century lows, even amidst record high perception that local crime has increased. Joining us now is Meryl Pontier, an attorney for Clinton Young, and legal director for the nonprofit Clinton Young Foundation, focusing on wrongful convictions for capital murder in Texas. Meryl, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Please, how do Europeans view use of death penalty in the U.S. in general, and Texas in particular?
Oh, we're absolutely shocked by the use of it. And I think the overwhelming majority in the Netherlands, which is where I'm from, is against the death penalty, and I think that goes for a lot of European countries. I think the Netherlands is one of the first countries that actually abolished it over 200 years ago. So we're all pretty outraged. And I think that's why there's so many Europeans coming into Texas or in the U.S. in general and helping out.
Do you have any advice for people on death row?
Oh, that's hard because, you know, I'm in a pretty privileged position. You know, I went to law school in two different countries twice, and I didn't go through anything similar like what all these people have been through. Not only have they all had very difficult lives, but then they've spent sometimes decades in solitary confinement. So for me to give them advice, I find that difficult. I find that difficult.
Can you give us an update on Clinton Young? We hope to have him join us here, but we're having a few technical difficulties. What's his status now?
We've had some difficulties. Yeah, I'm trying to get him in right now. Well, he still has two indictments for the same murder in two different counties. And the same prosecutors are on both cases, and so they're seeking two death sentences still, which is insane. And I've talked to judges about it, and they said this is unheard of. We've never seen anything like it. But that's still the status. He is no longer in jail. I mean, they arrested him in August, and he was in jail for like 2.5 weeks, but bailed him out again, and he's doing well. He's working. And still fighting. I mean, this case seems like it's never going to end. So we have to not give up and just keep up the fight.
What's the next step for Clinton?
Well, obviously, we want to do something about this indictment in Harrison County, the second one, which is a duplicate of the first one. So we're trying to get that dismissed because it is the same indictment.
Well, if we don't get to talk to him, please tell him hello for us and give him our best. You have anything else you'd like
will.
To add, Mel?
I definitely will. I'm trying right now to get him in, but it's, I guess it's hard with these technical difficulties that we have.
Mel Pontier, thank you so much for joining us. We truly appreciate everything you have to say, and how can people get in touch with the Clinton Young Foundation?
Well, I work on capital cases, both death penalty and life sentence cases, and I'm not sure how many cases I can take, but I'm always willing to look at other people's cases. They can just send me an email, info@clintonyoungfoundation.com, and I always try to reply, or people can just send a letter to the P.O. Box, which is listed on our website, but it's 2014-93, Austin, Texas, 78720.
Meryl Pontier, thank you so much for joining us, and please come back anytime.
Thank you. I will.
Yes. I believe now we have Linda Snyder, who is outside of the death house in Huntsville as well. Linda, can
yes.
you hear us?
We finally got on.
Hi, Linda. I know it's cold out there. I know it's dark. We thank you for letting
yes.
us know when the witnesses cross the road. Thank you for doing that. Has there been anything else going on?
No, nothing yet. The guards have been extremely nice out here tonight. They, you know, the victim's family came over here trying to stir up trouble with us, and they escorted him back over to the other side where they're supposed to be. And they really watched us closely because there's only four of us here tonight. You know, so it's kind of, it's just not, usually we have a lot of people and we don't tonight on our side.
Now, explain, if you don't mind, to our listeners on the radio, there are two sides, one for you who are arguing against the death penalty, and then another side for the family or other people. Explain to us, if you don't mind.
Well, we have the one side is where we're supposed to be the people that are protesting the execution. And then there's the other side of the building where the victim's family is supposed to go But for some reason, they ended up over here tonight and tried to stir up some trouble. But, you know, the guards were nice, got them back to their side where they're supposed to be, and they're staying over there now. So,
did you know Steve and Barbie?
No, I did not.
Do you know any words or anything that anybody has to say about
Stephen? He had a real good friend, Farron Wardrop, and he says very nice things about him.
I know that you see a lot of different people on death row, and we appreciate that, and we appreciate all the things that you do. When something like this happens, does it change your conversations with the death row inmates?
With the who?
The people that you visit on death row?
Yes, they're all, you know, it's like they're losing a brother, you know, a friend, because a lot of them have been, you know, with each other for 20-something years. And so it hurts them very much. It's like losing a family member. And the guys take it very hard. And some of them just haven't recovered, you know, even after 6 months, they still can't get over their friend dying. And it's hard. It's very hard on the guys.
We know that this year you've been in that exact place gathering for Carl Wayne Bunton, Kasol Chantakomain, John Ramirez, and Tracy Betty. Does this get any easier?
No, it doesn't get easier. No, it never will get easier.
It's fair, you know, to look at this from the folks on the row's point of view. It's been almost 25 years since they moved people from the Ellis unit to Polanski and essentially put everyone in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. And it's set up like a dog kennel. They have a fenced-in exercise run that they get to use themselves 1 hour. They don't really get much human contact except the visitations. So it's a very difficult situation, and I think it's normal for any bunch of human beings to be in that situation to try and lean on each other. And, you know, if they keep kicking the chair legs out from under people, then they're going to fall. And I think that's a human reaction that you can understand.
And for those listeners of ours who may not know this, a visitation literally is between very thick panes of glass. It's you sit at a desk, the inmate is on the other side, and there's no touching, there's no closeness, there's really nothing but a telephone that you speak into to actually address what's going on with the person on the other side of the glass.
If you wouldn't mind asking Linda, if they haven't come back yet, has there been any indication that it's complete at this point? Or
no, as far as we know, it's not complete until they come out of the building.
I do also want to say that it's not abnormal for a victim's family to be extremely emotional at these executions, and I think they're going through a lot of pain, and it's been a lot of years for them to get past this. It's a brutal crime, and they still have strong feelings about it, and that's pretty understandable as well. And if they happen to run into folks who are exercising their First Amendment rights to protest a policy they deeply disagree with, it's probably a little predictable that there would be some exchange.
Linda, may I ask how you got started doing this?
Well, my husband's brother-in-law was on death row for 27 years. His name was Guy Alexander. And he got me into it because when I married his brother-in-law, you know, he talked to me to come with him to death row. And that's how I got involved with it. And of course, now he's been moved to life. But he asked me to please keep visiting his friends because he said, I want to know what they're doing, how they're doing. And so I've kept doing it. So that's how I got involved.
And that's how you're there on this very cold evening in Texas outside of the Death House in Huntsville, Texas.
Yes.
Is there anything, what's going to make you stop doing it, Linda? Anything?
Probably, no, when I die. When I die, that's when I'll probably stop doing it.
And of course, you have a group of people with you that also help for taking care of the remains of some of these inmates. Is that right?
Yes. Danny's out here. She's our other death row angel. And
Danny Gann.
Danny Grand, yes.
Yes.
Hi, Danny.
And then the Rev is out here.
Hello, Rev.
He visits a lot of the inmates. He's the Buddhist monk. He's one of Patrick Murphy's spiritual advisors. Then we have another couple of ladies here that are just out here to protest with us. And that's Brandon and Linda and another lady. Beverly.
Linda, on the religious issue, if the Reverend would care to comment, has he ever run into difficulty trying to help any of the inmates as far as their spiritual concerns?
No, let me let you talk to him. Rev, they want to talk to you.
I actually also have Clinton Young on the phone.
Oh, it is 9 minutes until 7. Witnesses should already have come out of the death house.
They have left.
I'm hoping that because of his physical disabilities.
Go ahead, I can hear you.
With Stephen Barbie, there was not a problem. Hello.
Hi, Reverend, hold on 1 second.
That's Gloria.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Hi, Reverend Pat McCann. I wanted to ask you, do you consider yourself a spiritual advisor to some of the inmates?
Yes, I have been to 3 so far. Well, I say 3. I've been 2, and then with Gary Green coming up in March of next year.
And has the administration, and if you're a potential witness in any of these issues, please, tell me so I'm not stepping over a line, but are you experiencing any interference by the administration in your efforts to calm these men's souls as they face their final times?
The last one with Kasol Chantaman, they were very cooperative and nice to me the entire time. I usually get there early. They kind of go over the rules of what I can say and not say. And then, I was escorted into the chamber.
So do you feel you're at least giving as much comfort as anyone could have at that difficult moment?
Yes. I really try to encourage some of the other ministers. I know that with Casol and Gary Green, there is another minister, and we both visit or have visited these men.
So do you keep in touch with some of the other folks, whether they're imams or ministers or monks?
I don't really have any touch with any of the monks that I know of here in Texas, because that's where I'm concentrating on. But I am in touch with some of the families and some of the other ministers. We kind of coordinate our visits in a way because we don't want to overstep each other when we're visiting.
That makes sense. And I guess one last question for you, if you don't mind. And by the way, thank you for answering these impromptu questions.
Sir.
But when you're working with some of the men, and I don't know if you have any of the female folks as parishioners, I suppose. But if you're working with them, do you feel that the service that you're giving them is as valuable as probably the rest of us feel? Do you feel like you're helping them face what they have to face?
Sometimes it's kind of hard to tell because we kind of have to read into them, their expressions, feelings, the way that they say things, and then try to act or react from there. So we just go in and kind of, I know for me with Kasol, for example, the last visit that I had with him, actually the last 2 or 3 visits, I kind of left it up to him to what he wanted. These are his last hours, or those were his last hours. Other than that, then if they don't really have anything, then I try to go ahead and intervene spiritually. Sometimes that works, and sometimes just maybe talking about the Astros. They're always wanting to know about that. So I try to help them in any way that I can, sort of based upon their feelings.
Appreciate that answer, sir, and good luck to you.
And all right, thank you, sir.
Taking care of this.
Thank you, Rev.
Uh-huh. All right, thank you.
That was the Rev and Linda Snyder. Linda,
thank you for honking the stop.
Are you back with this? I can hear Gloria there as well. Do you have
yes.
anything?
And Texas,
so let me just verify one more time that they have not come out of the death house. Is that correct?
They have not come out. And you know, Stephen had said that they were going to have to break his arms in order to get the IV in because his arm won't move. It won't bend. And so we don't know if something's going on in there and they haven't been able to do what they need to do. I don't know. Because this is the latest I've ever seen anybody come out.
Thank you, Linda.
Usually it's like 6:36 when the family walks out.
Well, thank you so much, Linda. We appreciate it. It's time for us to wrap up Execution Watch for today. I'm sorry that we cannot tell you the status of what's happening with Stephen Dale Barbie, but it is time to wrap up Execution Watch. Please join us on January the 10th when Texas plans to usher Robin Frada into the death chamber in Huntsville. If it does, Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing with our live news coverage. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, we're on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Thank you to our guests. I'm sorry, Clinton, that we did not get to go to you. Meryl Pontier, Pat McCann, our panel, Larry Douglas, Death House reporter Linda Snyder, executive producer and interviewer Elizabeth Stein, Elise Bench and Zara Cooney, Otis McClay, and of course, Houston Media Source video director Mark Pirtle. For those of you listening live on KPFT 90.1 FM, stay tuned for Living Art. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.
Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?